Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Leslie McClurg in for Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, going through a breakup can hurt everywhere. It can be all-consuming. That's why a year after a bad breakup, LA Times journalist Todd Martins turned to science to try to understand why he was still stuck on his ex. He recently wrote the article, Science Can Explain a Broken Heart. Could science help heal mine? We'll talk to Martins to find out. And then we'll turn to experts for strategies to heal broken hearts. And we want to hear how you mended yours. That's next after this news. This is Forum. I'm Leslie McClurg. I'm in today for Mina Kim. And I have to be honest, if I had to host this show a year ago, I don't think I could do it because I was in the middle of heartbreak, which is today's topic. In my case, it was a divorce or is a divorce, and it was one that I was not expecting. My little girl was 3 years old at the time. I was totally crushed. Luckily, fast forward a year later, and I feel a lot steadier on my feet. And I'm very excited about today's show because I think I could have used some of the tips that the experts today will offer us on heartbreak. Our guests are going to help us understand why and how it can hurt so much to lose love. And we'll dig into the neuroscience that drives that pain. And we're going to get some really solid advice on how to open a broken heart again. We're joined by Todd Martins. He's a columnist with the LA Times, and he wrote Science Can Help Explain a Broken Heart. Could Science Help Heal Mine? And David Sabara. He's a psychologist and a professor at the University of Arizona, and he studied breakups for over two decades. And Mary Frances O'Connor. She's a grief researcher, a neuroscientist, and a psychology professor at the University of Arizona as well, and author of The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn from Love and Loss. So, Todd, I want to start with you. Usually you write about entertainment and Disneyland video games, and suddenly you're writing about the science of a broken heart. So tell us about this breakup. What was going on?
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. My partner and I broke up in November of 2022, and it took me by surprise. We had just moved in together. We were engaged. You know, I thought we had reached a point. If there was any sort of roadblock, we would, you know, use that as an opportunity for growth or, you know, just get past it. And, you know, so months and months were just going by, and I was in a pretty bad spot. I wasn't sleeping. I'm still not back to sleeping a full 8 hours. I'm sleeping maybe in 3 hour spurts, and then I'm awake for an hour. You know, as I wrote in the story, I found myself anytime, like, I'd have a pen and paper, I would just doodle her name. Was really sort of ruminating over it. You know, she designed a tattoo that's on my arm. So I found myself, like, in any sort of stressful moment, I would sort of grab the tattoo, you know, just really sort of relied on her for everything. And 6 or 7 months after the breakup, this was maybe in June of last year, that was probably my lowest point. And I think there wasn't necessarily anything that triggered it per se. I think maybe in the back of my mind, there had been a little bit of hope, like, oh, you know, we'll reconcile, we'll figure it out, we'll get back together. And I think I started to sort of go through a moment where I was like, well, what if we don't reconcile? So I think I started to spiral a little bit. And, you know, as you talked about in your intro, you know, you're going through something, you know, difficult, and especially if you're with somebody that you rely on and you just count on that you're going to be spending the rest of your life with them. You know, if there's any sort of challenge or roadblock, whether it's a professional work thing or a personal thing, you go to that person. So I started to feel like I needed to hear from her, and I needed, like, her to tell me things were going to be okay. You know, and that wasn't really an option. So I was spending a lot of time looking at all of our old photos, reading our old text messages, you know, saved our voicemails, listening to our voicemails, all that sort of brutal stuff that you're not supposed to do. And, you know, I just told my therapist one day, I'm like, I wish I had a new brain. And that sort of phrase stuck with me after the therapy session. And I just kind of Googled brain, heartbreak, science. And that set me on this journey of sort of writing about the science of heartbreak.
And was this heartbreak worse than others you'd had? It sounds like it kind of took you under and took you by surprise.
It's by far been the worst. It feels like, and there's a time, and there's a part of like shame or silliness that comes with that. Cause you're like, oh my God, I'm like, you know, like in high school or something, you know, it takes you back to like the first time you felt like pain or heartbreak or loss. This has been, it's been a really devastating, it's been like 15 months now, but it's been, yeah, a really devastating, year, almost a year and a half.
So when you started to dig into the research, unfortunately, it was not especially reassuring. So what did you find when you started to dig in and try to understand what was going on in your brain and in your body?
Yeah. So the first thing I discovered was an op-ed written by Florence Williams, and she wrote a terrific book called Heartbreak, A Personal and Scientific Journey. So if anybody's interested in this topic, they should look that up. In her op-ed, she referenced, you know, two or three studies, one by David Sparra, who's on the program. And so I started reading those studies. Those studies referenced other studies, and just going down this like rabbit hole of like all these scientific studies. And I found that these started to make sense to me in a way that like all the self-help books that I'd been listening to, all the audiobooks I'd been listening to weren't. And nothing against any of those books or any against any of that advice. I think it was just, you know, because it was one thing, it's one thing to say like, oh, don't look at your old photos and don't listen to an old voicemail. Like everybody sort of knows that. And I was still doing that.
It's so hard not to.
But it's another thing when you sort of learn like why your brain is sort of propelling you to do that. You know, and then I started to feel like I had a little bit more autonomy. You know, I discovered research from Helen Fisher, which was, she's done a lot of pivotal studies, and she did a pivotal 2010 study, her and her peers, she's with the Kinsey Institute. And, you know, they did a study where they looked at, they had people who had been gone through a separation. Some people who had been just like 2 weeks removed from it. Some people who had been 17 months removed from it. They showed them pictures of their former partner, and then they showed them pictures of somebody who was considered a neutral party. And sort of what they found was activity in like brain regions that deal with addiction. And, you know, you're going sort of through withdrawal, like the same area of your brain that is activated with, you know, alcoholism or heroin or any sort of, you know, substance we can think of is also like heavily active when you're like going through a breakup. And that started to make sense to me because I started to sort of use that language of like, okay, so I sort of have to starve the addiction if I'm going to sort of get through the day or get through the night without completely ruminating.
You write in the article, we are all just trying to stay on the wagon. Kind of elaborate on what you mean there. I mean, you hinted at it there with the addiction reference, but what do you mean we're just trying to stay on the wagon?
You know, that came, I was out to dinner with a couple friends who were both a little bit older than me. And one of them had sort of referenced, you know, and you're trying to reconnect, you know, going through the breakup, I'm trying to reconnect with everybody I've ever spoken to in my life and just trying to sort of try to keep some sense of community. And, you know, and this person had sort of mentioned that they went through a very difficult breakup, you know, like more than a decade ago. They're happily married now, but it's like occasionally I think of that person and occasionally I wonder what if. And I think in the middle of this depression of, you know, being like right in the middle of this breakup, I don't necessarily know if that reassured me. That started to sort of make me think that, you know, but it also made me think that there are some people who come into our lives who are just like incredibly important and, you know, touch us and change us, and they're going to stay with us, you know, forever. And that's certainly how I feel about my ex. You know, I'm not, I wanted to get to a point, and I'm not there yet, but I want to get to a point where it's like, if I think about her, like I smile and I'm just happy to have known her, you know, but yeah.
Well, Liz writes, I took my ex-boyfriend's goals and I made them my own. It's been 6 months post-breakup and has been wonderfully fun ever since. In the process, I lost weight, reconnected with old friends and new friends, and had what I call a glow up. I also made a list of everything I didn't like about him. I gave myself space to feel emotional when I needed to, but mostly I focused on the good. I traveled, I researched my ancestry, and found my grandfather's long-hidden NASA awards. my breakup was a blessing. It doesn't sound like you're quite there yet, Todd, but are you having moments or, you know, twinkles of a glow up? Are you finding yourself in new ways that maybe you didn't before?
Yeah, I've definitely tried to like take on new activities and take on new challenges. You know, one of the things I wrote about in the article is I discovered sort of the research of Dr. Keltner, and he studies, you know, awe, A-W-E. And, you know, and there's something that's kind of like abstract about awe, but I think that's kind of why I like it. You know, he sort of describes it as, and I'm paraphrasing, I think, but sort of being in the presence of something vast that, you know, transcends your understanding of the world. You know, and you could find that in art, you can find that in religion, you can find that in spirituality, visual design, music, nature. So I started volunteering at a local museum. I started volunteering at a local theater, just trying to sort of be like out in the world and be in the presence of art and be in the presence of, you know, community, be in the presence of live theater, be in the presence of, you know, being at the museum and being surrounded by all this like wonderful art and all this wonderful history. You know, that sort of definitely helped. And, you know, like I volunteer once a week, you know, usually on the weekends. And it's like every time I come home from volunteering at the museum, like I feel energized. And I usually end up writing for a couple hours that evening, just like on personal stuff, like non-work stuff.
And I just want to underline for everyone that it's okay to lay in bed if you can't, you know, get to awe, right? The laying in bed part is an important part of the process before you can maybe walk outside and take all that in. Did you find that, Todd, true? Like there's a time to just grieve though, right?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and I still sometimes want to do it. I still sometimes want to go back in bed and I still sometimes want to grieve. And I still want to pull up all of those old photos, because when you're looking at those old photos, like I'm smiling, I'm like happy. At the end of that ritual, I'm very sad and depressed. But, you know, during it, I'm very happy. And what I liked about sort of studying the science of this is, like Helen Fisher, she would say, well, the reason you are happy when you're looking at those photos is because you're having an addiction response. And so that is sending you this dopamine to your brain. You know, so that sort of explained, you know, why I would look at these photos and smile. You know, so there's parts of me that still want to do that. And some of this research has actually like helped me not do that. You know, I think of Stephen Cole, he's a researcher at UCLA, and he studies our immune system and our immune response. And, you know, if you're like, when you're going through a breakup, one of the areas of your brain that's also triggered is the area that feels physical pain. So if you're feeling emotional pain, your brain is registering that as physical pain. And when your brain is registering physical pain, it's sending out like fight or flight messages to your body. And, you know, stop me if this is getting like too in the weeds.
No, I mean, it's actually a perfect kind of cue. I mean, I am going to stop you just because we're going into a break, but we're going to get into that neuroscience, which I think is really grounding. It really helps explain why it is so hard to get over someone that you are deeply in love with. We're talking about heartbreak and why it is so crushing and how bad breakups can really, really hurt both physically and mentally. And we will get to how we can move on and heal. We're joined by Todd Martins. He's a columnist at the LA Times. David Sabara and Mary Frances O'Connor are both going to join us in this next hour. They're both from University of Arizona. David Sabara is a psychologist and a professor. And Mary Frances is a grief researcher and neuroscientist. We want to hear from you. Tell us about your brutal heartbreak. What helped you move on? What questions do you have for our expert? Call now at 866-733-6786.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Leslie McClurg. I'm in today for Mina Kim, and we are talking about heartbreak, why it is so crushing, and how bad breakups can really hurt both mentally and physically, and what we can do to heal and move on. Again, we're joined by Todd Martins. He's a columnist for the LA Times. David Sabara, who's a psychologist and a professor at the University of Arizona, who has specialized in breakups for the last two decades. And Mary Frances O'Connor. She's a grief researcher and neuroscientist and psychology professor at the University of Arizona. Her book is The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn from Love and Loss. Jolene writes on Instagram, Takutsubo, cardiomyopathy, is a literal scientific definition for the broken heart syndrome. It's when the heart actually weakens from sadness. You can literally die of a broken heart. I've been working through a painful divorce for over 4 years and still not as far along as I'd like to be. One therapist described my pain as complicated grief disorder. My current therapist told me about Takotsubo cardiomyopathy, and that's been really powerful to know that that is real in trying to actually psychologically heal my heart. It is real. So David, I want to turn to you. It is real. So what is going on in our heart and in our body physically when we are in the midst of a heartbreak?
Hi, Leslie. Thank you. It's great to be here. Hi, Todd. It's good to hear from you again, too. So I'm happy to talk about this and all manner of things. I mean, I think our starting point on a lot of this from our studies of divorce and romantic breakups is to begin to analyze and look at some of people's psychological responses to their separation experiences. So what are the thoughts that are going through their mind? How do those ruminative processes that Todd is talking about lead to cardiovascular reactivity or strong cardiovascular responses? And how do they set up a physiological profile that may be associated with ill health down the road? So literally, what is the narrative inside people's head? What stories are they telling themselves? What ideas are they going over and over again? And how are they caught in some of this prolonged grief? And Dr. O'Connor's a real expert in that. And so I would defer to her and turn over to her on this part.
Hi, it's great to hear from you, Todd, and really good to be on the program, Leslie. You know, it's so interesting. I think one of the things that really strikes me is that this addiction paradigm, which feels right? The idea that we yearn so much for a loved one who we're not with anymore, whether that's divorce or bereavement or estrangement or whatever, that yearning is so important. But I think that it's not addiction. And this is after thinking about this for many years. I think rather than thinking of yearning as craving, I think we can think of it as thirst or hunger. And the reason that I say that is because our loved ones, those really close attachments, are as vital to our survival as food or water. And so if you think about, you know, David and I are here in the Southwest, if someone has been without water for a long time, you can't stop thinking about anything else and you're motivated to get water. And, you know, but no one would ever say you were addicted to water. Right? Mm. Like that's just a normal, natural need. And so I think one of the challenges is that, like David was saying, we have this internal story. And if the story is the only place I'm going to get those needs met is from this person I'm no longer with, you're going to keep going over all those thoughts and memories and photographs instead of, I have to find a new way to get those attachment needs met. I'm going to go out and volunteer. I'm going to strengthen relationships with friends, like Todd was talking about. And I'm going to find new ways to get that need that is basic to our survival, to get that need met.
Well, let's bring a caller into the conversation. Lara in San Anselmo, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to say the thing that got me over a breakup that was the most healing was connecting with the women I call my sister exes, women who I bonded with, who were over what I'm calling our mutual mistake. They were the only ones who could really understand and validate and support what I had been through and who this guy really was in a way that nobody else really could. And I really want to encourage other people to do that, to be able to get that very specific sort of support and connection and validation.
I can totally resonate, Lara. I have a WhatsApp thread with other divorced ladies, and it's been not only, you know, really emotionally helpful, but also legally really helpful. So I think that community piece is so critical. Dave, is that a piece of when you're working with your clients, how do you encourage people to reach out and stay connected?
Sure. I mean, I think that's an excellent point, Laura, and thank you for bringing it up. I mean, there are a lot of different ways. Social support has many inroads to helping us. And one thing I would just like to highlight here, we understand it helps us emotionally. We understand it helps us reevaluate situations, and your friends say, you know what, you're a lot better off. This guy was a dud, you know, whatever it might be. And then it helps us informationally. But one of the things that I think is really important about the Connected with Sisters of X's group is that it also helps us reaffirm who we are as a person and recenter our sense of self. And in our work, going back a number of years now, we've really highlighted this self-identity, self-clarity about who you are and how you should spend your time as a central piece in the recovery and our adaptation to loss. And if we think about it, it makes a lot of sense. How we think of ourselves is very tied up in our relationships to other people. And when those relationships go away, our literal sense of how we should spend our time becomes very diffused, and it sort of becomes a big unknown. So having this community is important for many reasons: emotional support, informational support, practical support, and helping us restore our sense of self, I think.
Todd, you mentioned in the article that you created a heartbreak club with, I think, one of your former interviewees for the article. How has that panned out for you?
That's been incredibly beneficial. I was online one day and I saw this person who I'd interviewed years ago, and he just posted something about, the first time you're going to a museum or whatever, some sort of event that you went to with your former partner, like now you're going to it alone, and how difficult that is. And that just like really resonated with me at that moment. So I think I just shot him a note and I was like, thank you for posting that. I know we haven't spoken in 5-6 years. And then we just started speaking. We speak once a month and we check in on each other. We talk about progress we've made or setbacks we've had. And it's been really sort of like healing in that sort of sense. And we've been doing it now since for 11 months. So yeah, it's been one of the most healing things I've done.
Well, let's bring Chris into the conversation. Chris, you're on the air from San Francisco.
Hey, so I'm wondering if people who have low levels of dopamine to begin with, like people who experience ADHD, are going to be more prone to suffering in a breakout.
Mary Frances?
Yeah, it's such a great question. Wow, I think you might be a scientist. The thing is that we're really, it's such the beginning. There's such an infancy in our science right now. So what we know is that dopamine does change when we lose a loved one, whether that's breakup or bereavement. So that while we know that those neurochemicals change, including oxytocin and opioids as well, what we don't know is, are there these pre-existing differences, and that changes our experience of grief? Or is it that as we're grieving and those changes are happening, that they're making things worse or better for us, right? So it's that whole chicken or egg problem that scientists have. It's actually really hard to do prospective research because you have to interview people before the loss happens.
Right.
And then, stick with them for years until unfortunately they have an event like this. And that's how we can tease it apart scientifically.
Well, Ron writes, my biggest heartbreak was in 2014 when my wife died. It was more than just stress. It was like an amputation. Mary Frances, you have really studied this. This is kind of your piece of work, right? In terms of grieving the loss of a loved one. How do you hear that often, like an amputation, like losing a limb?
I think that's such a great metaphor, but I actually think this may be part of how the brain works. So what we know is that you have an encoding of that other person, right? You have a model in your mind, sort of an internal avatar of that person, but they're really overlapping with your internal understanding of yourself as well. So, for example, I use the word daughter to describe myself, right? That's a word that means me. But that implies there's two people in the world, right? So if my mom dies, am I a daughter? And I think it's because the brain actually encodes the we. And so like Dave was saying, when they're not in the world, now I have to figure out, well, am I a daughter? What does it mean to be a good daughter now? And that takes time. So I think it's really important to remember your brain is going to learn, but it's going to take longer than you think.
And I would even add to that, if I may, that the idea of being an amputee or losing a part of you is so apt in a lot of ways very early on in our studies of divorce, I would spend time speaking with people after our research interviews with them, and they would say things about derealization or feeling like, I just really can't describe what is so abnormal about this and so painful, but I'm going to give you an example. Like, I know this will sound weird, but literally the ground beneath my feet does not feel like it's the earth. Oh. Or I can only describe that I am a sailboat out in the sea, lost at sea. Metaphorical language helps encapsulate a lot of our psychological experiences, but in some ways the embodiment of it may actually be much more than metaphor.
Well, a listener writes, I've experienced romantic heartbreaks, which I've eventually recovered from, but my heart still hurts from a friendship breakup that happened almost 10 years ago. Do your guests have any thoughts on why friendship breakups can be so painful, and do they have any advice on how to recover from those? Is it any different, Dave, when it's a friend rather than a lover?
I don't think it's any different. I think you can actually think about it in a very similar way, and it can be quite painful. And I would say the starting point is understanding that fact can help normalize a lot of the experience. Our attachment relationships are organized hierarchically. And what this means is that we have multiple attachment needs met by multiple people. And if your best friend is meeting a lot of those needs, the loss can be as profound as a divorce with a spouse or any other kind of bereavement event.
I think of an attachment figure as that person you say, I will always be there for you and you will always be there for me. And it doesn't matter who that is. That could be your secretary.
Right.
And if it is intense and overlapping in that way, then that's going to be someone you're going to grieve if you break up with them or that relationship ends.
Mary Frances, kind of on that note, then talk about your gone but everlasting theory. I think that kind of helps encapsulate exactly what we're talking about.
You know, I struggled for a long time in my research to understand, why does grieving take so long, right? Like, the brain is actually very good at learning new information. You know, at the end of a semester, all my students that I've gotten to know, they all leave the classroom and I come back the next fall and new students are there. I never think to myself, gosh, where did they go? But that's not the experience that grieving people have. They continue to think about this person, or in many cases may even feel like, gosh, I just feel like they're still going to walk through the door. So I think that this is also coming from the brain. We think of the brain as one stream of information, but there's actually multiple streams. You have memories on the one hand. Todd knows the conversations that he had when they were breaking up, and he knows the reality of that. But that attachment encoding, that encoding of the bond, really does come with that belief that they are everlasting. I have given my heart to this person, and they have given me theirs. And they don't have to be in my presence for me to believe that they are out there. Now, both of these can't be true. They can't both be gone and everlasting at the same time. So if we think of this grieving as sort of a form of learning who I am again, like Dave said, or learning what I want to do with my time, it's going to take longer than we think, because your brain is really trying to reconcile these two impossible things to reconcile.
And I would also add, I think that's exactly right. And there are a lot of things we do to get in the way of that process.
Yes.
All the psychological machinations about what if, what could have been, why me, what will happen, what should I do, who will I find? I can go on and on, right? So we get the idea. But all of this is interrupting and may be important. I'm not saying it's unimportant. There are a lot of ways it is very important. We can talk about that. But it may be interrupting, stalling, or slowing this normative, healthy, adaptive grief process. So it's takes a long time in and of itself, and there are ways in which it can go awry.
Let's bring another caller into the conversation. Jim in Concord, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for this conversation. It's very prescient to me. So a few months ago to the day my partner died of cancer, we were together for 22 years, and I was there when he died. I was in the bed with him, and we had just a marvelous, incredible, beautiful, not perfect relationship. And in these past couple of months, you know, I've been dealing with it. And for a while, I took like two weeks off of work, And I got connected with friends and did a lot of walking and stuff and actually a lot of crying. But then I told myself, he's gone. It's not the why did he go, it's the how am I going to react to that. And so I've been going back to work, but not on the incredible maddening schedule I have. I'm an attorney, but I do it, you know, every day. And the thing is this, is that I feel that as long as I live decently, I'm connecting with my partner, because he was just the most decent, loving person in the world. And I don't feel that this is the end. It's not a factual thing. It's just my belief. But I feel that the best way he can be here right now is how I am acting. And I'm acting like he would want me to act, which is just loving people, being constructive, and just, you know, day to day. That's it. That's all I can say.
Jim, thank you so much for that call. Would you like to say your partner's name on the air just as a sort of memorative moment?
I also want to tell you that I think grief groups are really good, but this online stuff is not for me. I found a grief group with Kaiser that is in person, and that's really helpful. And his name was Timothy Christopher Snow, and he was 64 when he died, and he suffered from sarcoma for 5 years.
And he was a very
decent man. I just have
enough
love and respect for him. Yep.
Thank you so much.
And bless you all.
Bless you. And may your grieving, you know, take the ups and downs that it will and the time it will. And thank you for sharing such an incredible story about Timothy. We're going to a break, so we will save that call for after the break. We are talking about heartbreak, the incredible pain and loss of that, why it can be so incredibly crushing, as we just heard from Jim, and what we can do to heal and to move on. We're joined by Todd Martins. He's a columnist for the LA Times, David Sabara, who's a psychologist and a professor at the University of Arizona, and Mary Frances O'Connor. She's a grief researcher and neuroscientist and psychology professor at the University of Arizona. And we really want to hear from you. Tell us about one of those brutal heartbreaks. What helped you grieve? What is helping you grieve in this moment? What advice do you want from our experts? And maybe what did you learn from a bad breakup that you'd like to share with others? Email your comments and your questions to forum@kqed.org. You can find us on our social channels at KQED Forum, or give us a call now at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. And thank you for your vulnerability in sharing with us. Stay with us.
At Star One Credit Union, they're all about building long-term relationships and helping your money grow by making banking effortlessly easy. It's why they offer real great rates on home, auto, and solar loans. Star One provides super simple, everyday banking solutions, including a stellar digital banking experience that puts you first. Become a member at starone.org or drop by any of their Bay Area locations. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Leslie McClurg. I'm in today for Mina Kim, and we are talking about heartbreak. Why does it hurt so bad? We're going to get some expert advice on how to heal from that pain in this next segment. We are joined by Todd Martins. He's a columnist for the LA Times, and he recently wrote, "Science Can Explain a Broken Heart. Could Science Help Heal Mine?" David Sabara is a psychologist and a professor at the University of Arizona, and Mary Frances O'Connor is a grief researcher and neuroscientist at the University of Arizona. We want to hear from you. Tell us about a brutal heartbreak. Tell us what helped you move on, what helped you heal, and feel free to call and ask questions. To our experts, you can email your comments and questions to forum@kqed.org or find us on any of the social media channels or give us a call, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. A listener writes, is there anything different if you're going through a breakup at 70? Many of the coping mechanisms discussed here can be done at any age, but one of the coping mechanisms talked about is reconnecting with friends. However, once you get to a certain age, your friends may not be in the best of health, or they may be dead. How do you manage that? I know my mom is going through that at 80. Any advice, Dave, or let's start with you and then maybe go to Mary Frances.
Sure. I think in general, the advice would be pretty typical if it was someone in their 30s or 40s. I mean, the thing to do is to try to reach out to other people. I mean, there's some classic research in psychological science about the way people rekindle older attachment relationships during periods of loss. So, you know, when you're older, if you have children or family who are available, a lot happens over the course of our lives when we shift our relationships and priorities in different ways. So upon a loss, when you're older, looking to other people to rekindle those affiliative relationships is very important. Facebook is a great way to reconnect with people you might have lost if you're an older adult over the course of your life, and you might have lost touch with over the course of your life. But all this, I think many of the similar ideas still hold.
And I think one thing we've come to learn about older adulthood is, you know, we all think about those really important relationships in our life, our adult children, our close friends, our siblings that become really important sometimes when we're older. But there's something they also call weak ties. Mm-hmm. And this is the health effect of actually just interacting people at your coffee shop or the people that, you know, bag your groceries. Having those social connections, it turns out, is really important for our emotional and mental health as well when we're older.
It's one reason why the pandemic, I think, was so isolating. Exactly. Is we lost those, you know, the talk to the coffee person or go and talk to the person bagging your groceries. Well, Tom writes, my 12-year marriage ended at the start of the pandemic, which was a blessing and a curse. I reminded myself how much we were growing apart and how much pain she was causing me. As an artist, I'm used to rejection. Although not easy, I concentrated on my new freedom to spend more time painting and exercising. I am now so much happier, and I have more time to spend with supportive friends and family. Dave, you talk about this, basically, you know, get involved in the things that really make your heart sing. What are some of the practices that you do advise folks to do? I think one of them, you know, is get some more sleep, which is easier said than done. But what are some of the others?
Yes, we've worked a lot on sleep and done a lot of research related to sleep and adjustment and sort of what sleep problems may actually signal for us. But I think what Tom is saying is exactly right, is putting efforts into rediscovering who you are and what that sense of self is separate from your partner. One of the areas where we've done a large amount of research is in this concept, around this concept called self-compassion. And the concept of self-compassion is essentially a stance that people can take with respect to their psychological experience. It has three pillars. First pillar is self-kindness. So figuring out a way to treat yourself as you would a dear friend, right? So not being overly critical, not, you know, really not talking down to yourself in all kinds of ways. The second pillar is a mindfulness pillar, and practicing some degree of mindfulness, which we define as a non-judgmental, present-focused awareness. So instead of being caught in the story, engaging activities, whether it's meditation, walking, or anything else that can bring you back to the present moment and help you move forward. But the third one, and this came up in different kind of ways, I think to some extent what Todd was talking about with respect to awe is circles around this third pillar. And the third pillar is common humanity, is locating your experience as part of all human experience and understanding that you are, although you are personally suffering from this loss, you are not the first person to experience loss, and you're not going to be the last, and that you're part of a pageantry of people who are moving through life and the ups and downs and slings and arrows that are difficult to navigate. And that's part of what the fabric of our existence is, and trying to connect to that in some way, I think, is very important.
I will say I didn't really ever want to be part of the divorce club, but you mm-hmm. are kind of all of a sudden part of the divorce club when and there's a certain connection there, kind of like, I get it. I know that path.
But it may even be broader than that. It may be, I mean, my grandfather used to say, into every life a little rain will fall. It may be not just the divorce club, but the ups and downs that come with being alive and noticing that this is a time in which you have to treat yourself a little more sensitively and a little more kindly as you navigate through the darkness.
Through the rain,
Through the dark waters. A listener writes, I'm going through a slow breakup now. We've known each other for 9 years and have been engaged as well. He broke it off a few weeks ago. We still share a bed, share meals, travel, and laugh together. It's even occasionally intimate. It's civil, although there's an undercurrent of sadness. I'm starting to reclaim relationships that I deprioritized, understanding my own value in the deepest way, and look forward to using the available time to get back into other practices, like making music and writing. Creation helps stave off the destruction. That brings a good question up. Do you all recommend staying engaged like this with an ex or being friends, you know, after a relationship? Mary Frances?
You know, we think of after a death of someone, we talk about continuing bonds, right? This way that you continue to have an internal relationship with that person, even though they're not in the physical world. And modern psychology actually thinks continuing bonds can be really healthy. So then the question is, well, what if they haven't died? What if you're divorced from them or you break up with them? I think this is, one of the keys here is, what is your internal relationship like with that person? So I myself am a divorced person, and I knew that it was not going to be possible for me to stay in close touch when we divorced because ourselves were so overlapping. It was going to take me time to figure out how to disentangle myself from that. In that case, I think it's sort of a case-by-case basis. I still could call on her when I needed advice about work, right? Like I knew what she would tell me. Mm-hmm. And so it's possible to make sure that you're okay with that internal relationship that you're having with them. And that can be separate from the external relationship that you're having with them. When she drops off the dog, I do have to have a conversation with her, but it doesn't mean we have to get into everything when that happens.
Right, and I would add that this can be especially difficult in divorce situations of divorce where there's shared custody and, you know, reworking that relationship and moving from a romantic partnership relationship to a more like a business relationship, redefining that relationship, redefining those boundaries is very important for custody related topics.
And very difficult as one who is going through it. Mm. And when we're like the needs are very different. Like my partner needed a lot of space and that was really required for the healing of his heart. Whereas I was like, we have a 3-year-old. What do you mean? Like we got to go to the park together still. Right. We got to have a birthday party together still. And he was like, no, we don't. And so really learning to honor that, I think, has really helped move our relationship to a healthier place.
Very much.
Let's bring Janelle into the conversation. Janelle, you're on the air in Oakland.
Thank you so much. So when I had my biggest breakup, which was leaving my marriage, I told my aunt who, this is just an idea of how I felt better. I told her, my aunt, and she said, I hate to tell you this, but you're going to be fine. And so are the kids. Mm-hmm. And I know that that's not true for everyone, but I don't know why it made me feel better, but it did. Another thing that made me feel better when I was breaking up with my now ex-wife was that I didn't think I earned or deserved half the blame, but I intellectually espoused the concept that it was 50% my fault, and it's almost like the moment I did that, I felt better. Mm-hmm. It didn't change any outcomes, but it did feel better. And one of the most important realizations I made was that we had done a lot more than fail at our relationship. We'd bought a home, we'd buried grandparents, and we brought into mm-hmm. the world two amazing kids. So like more than when you break up, what really helped me was realizing you did a lot more than just fail or not continue the relationship. You know, you did some good things. But really my most curious concept about love, and I hope the experts can speak to this, is what I have noticed as just an individual human being looking at the world around me and for myself is that as great as my capacity is to feel pain, and it is great, it is matched exactly by my capacity to feel love. And I wonder if that is just me trying to put a silver lining on things or if there's any scientific conceptualization of the matching capacity of, you know, the depth to which you can feel pain and the height to which you can feel love.
Mary Frances, do we have any scientific evidence? Do we know?
It's a great question, and so many wonderful things in what you've said that I'd love to respond to. But in this one specifically, there is an understanding of the world that is expanded when we truly understand loss. With loss often comes a lot of things, a lot of meaning that you can't really get before you have this experience. So for example, the fragility of life, the way I have to treasure my friends and my partner now, because I know that it isn't forever, right? Like there is a matching there in the sense that you really are able to learn that by having loved and been loved. And so the what people learn is different in each circumstance. Another person might learn, wow, I'm stronger than I thought. I never thought I would get through this. Or another person might learn, wow, I really have to seize the day, right? Like I have to do the thing in my work that I really feel motivated to do. So there's lots of ways to do that, but it is going to take time, right? Like I just want to normalize this does not happen on day two or day 20 or even day 200. But the research shows the vast majority of us do adapt.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Leslie McClurg. I'm in today for Mina Kim. And again, we're talking about heartbreak, why it's so crushing, and how bad breakups can really hurt. We're joined by Todd Martins, a columnist for the LA Times, David Sabara, a psychologist and a professor at the University of Arizona, and Mary Frances O'Connor, a grief researcher and neuroscientist at the University of Arizona. I want to just touch back into that call we just had with you, Dave. She mentioned, you know, other than a failure, it sounded like she had a narrative about what it meant for their marriage to end. What do you do, or what do you advise people to do about the narrative? Like, is the end a failure, or do you try to rewrite that for folks? How is it important to sort of craft a story about your relationship?
Sure. Thank you. Good question. I mean, Janelle's comments here are really excellent. There are so many ways to look at it. I just want to go in reverse briefly. I would say that the capacity to feel pain and the capacity to feel love, I mean, that's probably why I'm doing this work. I mean, she is onto something that's been a through line in my career for the last 25 plus years, that when I started to think about what is it that underpins human well-being, what is the central defining feature of our lives, it's our relationships. And that's really why I wanted to do this work over the course of my career. So I'm right there with her. But just to go back to the follow-up question, one note I wrote down when Janelle was speaking, as she's coming to these realizations, she said a very powerful force for her was the idea told to her by an aunt that you're going to be fine. And that was a realization that helped her come to a conclusion about this very difficult experience. And there's some really, really important work in this area by Ethan Cross, who's a professor at the University of Michigan. And he studies how people relate to their internal psychological experiences, the narratives in their mind. And he distinguishes between recounting and reconstruing. Recounting is the process of going over and over and over an event with no real end point. We recount, we recount, we recount the details of what happened. To reconstrue is to take an event, process it, and come up with an alternate narrative ending. It doesn't need to be a happy ending. It doesn't need to be a good ending. It needs to be one that is palatable for you in the moment. And that's very central to grief and healthy adaptation. So in the case of a divorce, it might be like, you know, this is a really crappy experience. You know, right now it's really, really hard, but we tried our best. We did everything we could. We went to therapy. We tried this for a year. It just didn't work. It's not that she's a bad or I'm bad. It's just not happening for us. That's very different than being stuck in the narrative about how awful things are.
And it sounded like Janelle was doing that. You know, she was saying it was a failure, totally. But in the same moment, she was saying, but we also had two kids. We bought a house.
Those realizations, that's a very powerful reconstrual process.
Todd, are you at that stage yet? Are you rewriting in a positive way yet?
I'm getting to that stage. You know, I think every one day at a time. You know, I think just talking to my therapist pretty recently, I had a moment where I was like, you know, I want to know what my former partner thinks about X, Y, or Z that's currently happening in my life. And then I'm like, you know, it's like, I feel like I need to know what you would think about X, Y, or Z to actually accomplish those things. I don't know how I'm going to accomplish them. And my therapist is like, you're going to accomplish them the same way you've accomplished everything else for the last 15 months. Mm-hmm. You know, like you're just going to continue to do it. So it is something you need to be constantly reminded of, you know, even if your brain has been rewired a little bit to constantly think of being in a partnership.
You know, I just want to add that I think supporting that feeling of even despair, you know, we don't think of that as being important, but I just really want to support Todd's experience here in the sense that it's really important in that learning curve to have a moment of despair. I'm not talking about ongoing depression, but despair says, oh, wow, no, they're not coming back. There's nothing I can do about this. And that is an awful, awful feeling. And it is also true. And so to be able to sit with that truth can actually help us to learn. Now, an important part of that is that's not the end point, because that despair says, this is awful. It's never going to get better. And I'm never going to be able to live a good life again. That part's not true, right? The despair is true. There's nothing I can do. She's not coming back. But with people around us, we can lend our hope. I hear that's exactly how you feel right now. And that's okay. That's where you're at. Mm-hmm. I can also see from the outside that you are going to have a time where that's true. And you also get to enjoy your kids or do something new at work, right? So I think that supporting that despair and contributing that hope is important.
Well, a listener writes, I broke up long ago with someone who was abusive emotionally because of their alcoholism and codependency. It was easy to just see them as bad for the first few years, but it taught me in the years since to protect myself, to forgive, and see the whole human behind the addiction. The bad has long healed over, and the good is all that remains. That is it. That is, the time is so, so important. I mean, I look back at the last year and it's like a totally different experience 1 year later. And I imagine you are also feeling that. Todd, thank you all so much for joining us. We were talking about heartbreak, why it's so crushing and how bad breakups can really hurt. And you all really just fleshed it out and made it so real. Again, we were joined by Todd Martins, a columnist at the LA Times. He wrote, "Science can help explain a broken heart. Could science help heal mine?" I recommend the article. David Sabara, a psychologist and a professor at the University of Arizona, again, has studied breakups for 2 years. Thank you for your work, David. And Mary Frances O'Connor, a grief researcher and neuroscientist and psychology professor at the University of Arizona. Check out her book, The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn from Love and Loss. Again, thank you all, and thank you so much to our listeners. Have a great day.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.